Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The spread of koki frog heads mauka here on Oahu. Who are you going to call? A drone team, for one. Aerial treatments have helped in the battle against little fire ants, so why not try it against the noisy, invasive critters? But there's also a need for an audio recording team as well. We'll explain. We talk fish ponds and fish, how to bring more indigenous voices to fishery science. And small businesses can look to expand to markets outside of Hawaii. We'll share where they can get help from experts who want to help spur growth in Hawaii's business sector. It is Thursday, September 26, day 9 of our fall membership campaign. You heard it here first. We featured a segment yesterday with University of Hawaii at Hilo biologist Patrick Hart, who is using audio recorders in the forest to capture songbirds. Hart mentioned that he was just starting a project on the detection of koki frogs here on Oahu. Well, the Department of Land and Natural Resources announced it has found the noisy frogs up in a remote area of Kuleo'o Valley, and it is about to begin using drones to help eradicate the invasive species. And Professor Hart and his team is assisting by helping them use recording devices in the forest to detect frog colonies. Josh Atwood is Information Specialist for DLNR's Forestry Division. Ryan Chang is the crew leader for the Koki Frog Team. Chang starts us off.
So right now we are doing low-tech kind of voice recorders. We set them out with some PVC housing, stick them in there, and then we turn them on and we listen for koki. And then we send that file over to Patrick Hart's lab. I'm in contact with this wonderful person named Amanda, and she's analyzing those tracks, and we're going off of like how much it's calling, how loud it's calling, and somehow they can figure out what the density is and possibly how many frogs there are.
So how long have you been doing this out here?
So in Kuleo'o, we haven't set out sound monitors yet. We are doing the population in Waimanalo, and we're testing it out there. The Kuleo'o population is a very remote location where we would have to fly in crews. If not, we would be hiking for, you know, a few hours up the mountain and then setting out these things, and you would have to carry it on your back, basically. For the Waimanalo area, we can drive up almost to the spot and we would hike in 20 minutes. And that's where we're kind of testing a lot of the equipment, such as the sound recorders and possibly the drone application.
Well, I remember years ago, probably a decade ago, going out with the Department of Agriculture officials at night in Waimanalo looking for koki. You know, we had the lights on the headband attached to our heads, you know, out there searching. And if I recall that night, it was very windy and we didn't hear a lot of koki because I guess they don't like the wind.
Yeah, they're more acquainted to the more moist air. When it's a little bit more windy and it's cooler, the koki don't call as much.
And Josh, jump in here. So, you know, what is it that we need to know about this latest discovery over at Kuleo'o?
I think for forestry and wildlife, one of the most troubling things is that koki frog is an ecological pest. And to have it get up into our mauka areas is really troubling for us. So most people think of koki frog as a residential pest. You know, it makes noises outside of homes and makes it hard to sleep. Or they might think of koki frog as an agricultural pest, which it is. It can move around in potted plants and nursery material. But koki are also ecological pests in that they eat native invertebrates. There have been studies showing that they can eat native snails. And so they can have these impacts on our ecosystems that when they're down at low elevations, maybe they're not impacting too many native species. But to find them up at elevation in the summits of the Ko'olau, that's really concerning for us as an agency concerned about the safety of our native species.
Oh my gosh, yes, because you're doing so much work to try and protect our native snails. I know we've talked to David Sisko many times about that tremendous effort that's underway. So yeah, that would not be good news.
Exactly, yeah. And so we have been working with David Sisko just trying to figure out, you know, we don't suspect that there are a lot of kahuli populations in this Kuleo'o spot that we're finding koki frog in now because there's already a lot of predators in that area. But it is something that we're looking into, and we're hoping to work with David's lab to go out and find or do some surveys for any remaining kahuli in that area. But certainly across the stretch of the Ko'olau, you know, if this population isn't controlled, then as it spreads, that's going to be a much bigger concern for us.
And so share with our listeners again, how did we get turned on to this problem? Who flagged it first?
So it was submitted as a report from a member of the public through 643pest.org or 643pest, the telephone hotline, which goes to the Department of Ag and some other partners. And so that's a really important note, that we rely on the public to keep their ears open, keep their eyes open, and let us know what they see. So this was submitted and then verified in the field by Department of Ag, and then surveys were done by the Oahu Invasive Species Committee and Forestry and Wildlife to figure out the extent of the population.
So it really is all hands on deck. All these different agencies are helping each other out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a big partnership model. And again, it's really important for the public to submit reports when they detect something that they think might be invasive in the wild.
So do we know how they might have gotten up in this area? I mean, do you think the birds might have snatched some frogs and dropped them up there or what?
I think that's something we don't know yet. So this is the first detection at elevation for Kuli'o'o. And so we're not yet sure how they got to this spot. Maybe that's something that we can learn over time as we continue to do surveys.
But it really does underscore that, yeah, the public is your eyes and ears.
Absolutely, yep.
And then, Ryan, what else can you tell us about this effort that you're mounting to do aerial treatment?
Yeah, so I think the plan is we are going to be flying in crews, and since the area is so steep and the drainage down into where the koki frog are, it is very treacherous. I think it's important that we keep everyone's safety in mind, the field crews, and we're using this new technology, and we really don't know if it's going to work, but we're trying to test it out to see if it works. We're still trying to come up with other plans if this thing falls through. So that's kind of the plan, praying that it works. And I would like to add one more thing about, like, besides the ecological impacts, yeah, that there's a lot of cultural impacts with invasive species. Koki frogs make a really loud chirp. And the cultural impacts for that, you know, like the sound of the wind in that area is called pu'okona. That will be erased during the night if these koki frogs persist, yeah? The sound of the rain, which is na'ulu, yeah, that's the name of the rain in that area. That will be erased if koki frogs persist in Kuli'o'o.
So you're basically saying all that is going to be drowned out by the sound of koki.
Correct. Yeah. And that's a huge blow to, you know, our practitioners, you know, Hawaii in general. It is part of what makes Hawaii. So these invasive species impact more than the ecological impacts. Yeah. So the most difficult part with treating koki frogs is that they are nocturnal creatures. They come out at night and they call at night. During the day, they are burrowed in leaf litter, under the duff, under the dirt, under logs. They're not out. So that creates a challenge where we can't do helicopter operations at night at the moment. But with the drone, we can fly at night and we can apply citric at night. And that's on a landscape level kind of control. That's what keeps our, you know, staff and personnel safe, is that we have this tool and we want to utilize it.
You're spraying this acid, and that's proven to be helpful in knocking these populations down?
Correct. So citric is the only approved treatment method so far. There are other methods, but they're not legal right now.
If I can just jump in, the other thing I'd add about citric is that, you know, people hear acid and it sounds concerning, but this is a food additive, and so it's very safe for humans. It breaks down in the environment quickly. There's been studies about whether or not it's going to impact other native animals, such as the opeapea. And, you know, this is something that has been used on Hawaii Island for a long time now, since they've unfortunately had koki for a long time. And it's a very safe treatment product. It's deadly to the koki only because they're amphibians, and it's something that's absorbed on contact through their skin.
And is this powder form, liquid form?
It's a liquid form, yeah. Citric is mixed with water when it is applied, and so it's something that will be sprayed in a liquid mixture.
And will it impact any of our, you know, flora, fauna
You know, not that we've found. So if it's sprayed continuously at, high levels, it can impact plants and so kind of cause a little bit of leaf dieback. But with the amounts that we're going to use in this operation, I don't know that that's a major concern. So, you know, impacts to other species is always something that we consider when we design an operation. And so we're certainly working to make sure this is going to have very little impacts to anything other than the Koki frog.
And then when do you plan to start doing this? Because, you know, we do want to alert the community, you know, in the area, even though, you know, this might be in a remote area where you're dispensing this.
Do you want to take that, Ryan, on the timing?
Sure. We don't have a set date yet on the application. I believe the earliest that we could do that is probably late October. We do have a neighborhood board meeting for Kuleo'o to answer any questions, to let them know how we plan to do it. Right now, we are still in the testing phase of this drone application. So we want it to be effective, and so we don't want to fly everything up and it not be effective. We would have to revert to a secondary plan of some sort.
And Josh, recently, I believe it was Hawaiian Electric reported that they had some damage done to their drone, and they were trying to, you know, let the community know that, hey, you know, they need these tools up in the air to do work with their lines in these remote areas. But you want to let the community know that you're doing this so they know what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason we want to be so engaged with the community on this and be transparent about, you know, the timing of it and what tools we're going to use. You know, people understandably have a lot of concerns about drones that people use for photography. There's a lot of rules about that. But, you know, we want people to be aware that sometimes these drones can be excellent tools for conservation work or for agricultural work. And so, you know, we appreciate if people, you know, don't shoot at drones that you see out there on the landscape, because they might be doing something really helpful. And so we're hoping that this is a use for drone technology that can really do some good for us here in Hawaii. There's so many places that we can't reach on foot to do conservation work. And so this is something that we're looking at as a really helpful tool for the future.
Okay, but then hopefully once you finalize the schedule, then we can help get the word out to the community.
Yes, yeah. And so as Ryan mentioned, yeah, we'll be at that October 2nd neighborhood board meeting. And then as October goes on, they'll know a little bit more about the treatment schedule.
Anything else you want to leave our listeners with just about the impact of these invasive species and the tremendous work that, oh gosh, is needed to, you know, keep these populations in check or eradicate them?
I would just reiterate what you said earlier about this being all hands on deck, and those hands are not just agencies or community partnerships like the Invasive Species Committees. It's everybody that lives here in Hawaii. This is going to impact all of us if koki frog and other invasive species continue to spread in our communities, but also in our mauka areas. So we thank everybody for reporting invasive species detections and then just being patient with us as we try to figure out the best ways to control and hopefully get rid of these populations. It's been done before. Right here on Oahu, there was a population in Wahiwa 20 or so years ago that, you know, we can control koki frog populations, but it takes a long, concerted effort. And this one is going to be a challenge. So we thank everyone for their patience and for continuing to let us know when they hear koki frogs.
Ryan, so then is Patrick going to give you some of those recorders, or do you guys get money together to buy them? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, so we've purchased recorders, more voice recorder style. There are more expensive ones on the market, but we've purchased and we set them out. And the method to that is we'll set them out before. We'll pull them back in, send the data over to Patrick Hart. And then after the treatment, we'll set them out again and, you know, analyze it again and then see if our treatment is effective. So if the densities go down and the calls go down, we'll continue with, you know, it being effective and continue on that path.
That was Ryan Chang and Josh Atwood, who work for the Forestry Division of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. They were talking to us this morning about the detection of koki frogs in Kuleo'o Valley. They're planning to use recording devices and drones to help eradicate the invasive frogs from this remote part of East Honolulu.
Support Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
The annual American Fisheries Society conference brought over 2,000 people to the Hawaii Convention Center last week. It featured sessions on how to MacGyver problems in fisheries. It also highlighted results from a statewide invasive fish species roundup and a spawning run. Cecil Jennings is the president of the society. He organized the annual meeting and a panel entitled Celebrating Indigenous Fisheries Stewardship. It featured Native Hawaiians as well as Native Americans from tribes across North America. Jennings spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about the push to diversify fishery science and how Hawaiians can add to the conversation.
As president, the theme of the conference was sort of left to me to figure out what I would like to highlight. And I was aware of Hawaii's very long history of sustainable natural resource management. This is sort of pre-contact. I was aware a little bit about some of the fish ponds. And in addition to just the uniqueness of this locale and its history and culture, AFS also tries to have outreach to whatever minority communities are in the areas where the meetings are being held. Like in Spokane, Washington, a few years ago, we had a really big outreach to the Native American community. A few years before that, we were in the D.C. area. We had a really big outreach to about four or five different historically Black colleges and universities that were in that area. So what you saw in Hawaii is the most recent addition of sort of a planned outreach with AFS to diversify our profession, because frankly, it hasn't been that for a long time.
I thought the panel that you organized, specifically bringing together a range of those voices, was quite interesting. So how did that come about, and what did you intend for everyone to be able to learn from one another?
There's a growing body of academic literature that talks about that there are other ways of knowing. And I was familiar with this literature. And, you know, I'm a trained PhD level scientist in the Western tradition of science, worked for 35 plus years as a researcher. So I'm well ingrained in that culture, but I'm from the Caribbean as well. I was born and raised in the Caribbean, and I understand that sometimes we see people come from quote unquote outside with these ideas that are not consistent with what we know locally. And so I had a sort of a fundamental understanding that there are other ways of knowing besides, you know, what the dominant practice is. And so part of my objective with the panel was just to introduce folks to the idea that, you know, maybe there are other ways of knowing and each has value, and it's not a matter of one being better than the other, but they maybe complement each other in a way that, you know, one has some structure that the other doesn't, but another one has a very long tradition that the science structure doesn't, and it's not one or the other, but we both have something we can learn from each other. And so that was the idea behind the panel. One of the plenary speakers was Dr. Kavika Winter from University of Hawaii. And like me, he is a trained scientist in the traditional mold. He talked about there's a pretty long-standing mathematical model used to estimate production of fishes from various populations. It's called maximum sustainable yield. And that's turned out to have not been a very effective strategy, and a lot of fisheries that were managed with it collapsed. And Kavika is now advocating a different approach, one called maximum sustainable abundance, where it's not the most we can get from the ocean and have it survive, but how do we manage the ocean in such a way that it can produce at its maximum abundance? So it completely flips the idea on its head. And that's sort of the thing that I was interested in. Three of the four plenary speakers are Native Hawaiians who spoke about their history and culture and how they work. And one has been here for decades working on aquaculture for the fish ponds. And so they all are looking to sort of traditional ways of managing. And Dr. Winter's approach about maximal sustainable abundance is another example of how a different way of knowing or co-producing knowledge between indigenous and scientific ways.
And do you think that attendees benefited from hearing these other perspectives? And do you think there ways in which they can take that knowledge back to the communities in which they work and apply that and tailor that to the areas they're from?
Yes, absolutely. And when I say attendees, I'm going to divide that into two groups. And so they're the sort of indigenous folks. And we actually had quite a large turnout of indigenous folks who told me personally that this was their first meeting, first conference like this, and that they appreciated being seen and heard and welcomed, which was something new for them. So from that perspective, I'm really pleased with how that turned out. But from the other perspective, folks like me who are trained in the Western tradition, you know, if I could convince my colleagues that when they go to an area, they should listen to the wisdom or the natural history perspectives of the folks indigenous to the area, then all of us would benefit from the combination of methods to produce better actionable science.
And you've been in this field for quite a few decades at this point. Do you feel like indigenous voices have been highlighted to the degree that it seems like they are now?
No, absolutely not. In fact, they were sort of ignored. And, you know, folks would go in and take what information they wanted and then sort of discard the rest, maybe with the bathwater, for lack of a better analogy. But there's a clear recognition now, and not just anecdotally, people's personal experiences, but a growing academic literature that speaks to the value of indigenous knowledge and the benefits there, too.
Were there opportunities to get out of the convention center and to see, you know, a local IA or tour other ways in which fisheries are being managed here?
Yes. One of the groups that we had, one of the committees we had, was how to be a respectful guest. And so we had a bunch of community outreach activities. One of them was a fishing tournament among all the islands to round up invasive species. Another was we had a work day at one of the fish ponds where we loaded up a busload of folks and took them out to one of the fish ponds and, you know, helped to clean it up, pick up trash. We also had a beach cleanup day in Ala Moana Park.
And there was, that reminded me, there was a 5K with kind of a funny name, right?
Yeah, the spawning run. It's funny. It's the spawning run for people that run, and people my age, it's the carcass crawl because we walk.
Is there anything else you want to add or anything going forward that you're now thinking about and other attendees might be thinking about?
Yes, a few. One is that we are very much appreciative to Hawaii and Hawaiians with whom we interacted. We had a really good conference. Everybody was friendly and welcoming. I'm hoping that the indigenous folks, both local and from the mainland that were here, continue to feel seen and heard, appreciated and welcome. And my Western trained colleagues, that they will get a better handle on, you know, the notion that there are other ways of knowing and this idea of knowledge co-production has value. That's what I'm hoping folks take away from this conference.
That was Cecil Jennings of the American Fisheries Society talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the annual meeting that was just held here in Honolulu.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
CNBC published an article this past July naming Hawaii as America's worst state for business in 2024 for many reasons, including recent disasters and the high cost of living. Overcoming these challenges is part of the reason the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism is holding its Hawaii Small Business Fair at Leeward Community Center this weekend. The event provides resources for local businesses, including how to expand to markets beyond Hawaii. The conversations Russell Subiono recently sat down in our studios with the Department's Business Development Branch Chief, Jamie Lum.
What motivates the state to help out so much?
I think it's just to help our community, you know, whatever their interests are. You know, of course, there are certain industries we might be looking to grow on the energy side and, you know, creative industries and those kinds of high tech. You know, they say that small business, not only in Hawaii, but in the U.S., is the backbone. So right. whatever someone's passion is and whatever it is that they see themselves trying to make a living out of, we really want to help support that.
The thing that caught my eye about the upcoming Small Business Fair is that there would be resources there to help local businesses expand to markets beyond Hawaii. And that seems kind of key to long-term success of many of our small businesses. I imagine many attain a level of success and growth with support from Hawaii residents, but it seems that continual growth or long-term growth comes when they're able to find customers outside of our state. What kinds of things can business owners learn about expanding beyond Hawaii?
Well, first of all, business owners can learn that, you know, Hawaii is a small market and that really over 95% of the consumers in the world are outside of the U.S. So, you know, there's a lot of potential right there. And I think that Hawaii has a lot of, you know, different and unique products and services that we can offer. And so it's just trying to find those markets that find our Hawaii goods and services attractive and then pursuing those markets.
Does it involve a lot of understanding of mastery of internet marketing and sales or understanding of import-export processes to be able to expand? What kind of skill set does it involve acquiring to be able to sell outside of the state?
It depends on the approach. You know, a lot of companies now are doing e-commerce and online sales, particularly during the pandemic that expanded. So from that standpoint, it's really learning, you know, what are the best platforms, whether they find a platform like a Amazon or Shopify, or if it's something that they want to do on their own website and really invest in building that up. And then it's a matter of, you know, in that case, dealing with the shipping, the logistics, and taxes. But if you're going to actually find an importer in a country that's going to bring in your products and then distribute them, and then just deciding, you know, if you want to go into retail outlets or just exactly how you want to do it in that market, then there's a little bit more of a learning process in learning the system on that end, in that country, you know, wherever it is that you're trying to sell.
I imagine that there are plenty of consumers out there that already have an affection for things from Hawaii or things that are Hawaiian. Does our culture and people's preconceptions of us, does it give us like an advantage when it comes to selling to markets outside of Hawaii?
I think it can, because it seems that kind of a trend worldwide is that consumers are really interested not only in the product, but the story behind the products. And so I think from that perspective, our culture and our place has a lot to contribute towards the attractiveness of whatever the product or the service is, you know, to the consumers outside of Hawaii. So definitely it would play a big role, I
think. Do you have an example or like a good story of a local small business that was able to sustain and grow by being able to expand outside of Hawaii?
Yes, we have a few. There's one in particular that I actually use this company a lot as a success story. They're a tea company. So they're just about 30 years old. And I think maybe about 15 years after selling in the local market, then they thought, you know, let's try to see what's out there. And so the owner started by actually taking some classes, program called Export 101, which actually was put together by the U.S. Department of Commerce. Oh, and we've since incorporated that into our High Step program. And then just kind of taking advantage of all the different resources that were out there, either through U.S. Department of Commerce. And then when we started to get funding from the SBA for the High Step program, they enrolled in that and they started going to trade shows and just getting a little more educated on what exporting entailed, and went to trade shows year after year, eventually found an importer, found a distributor. And I believe what he said is that they've seen about a 30% increase in revenue over that period of time, say close to 10 years or so that they've been doing this. They were also one of those quite affected by the pandemic. This company wasn't doing a lot of online sales. And then in 2020, lost about 80% of their revenue with the shutdown.
Wow.
So quickly turned to e-commerce, started to just, again, get educated, and then was able to start to recoup some of that lost revenue because of e-commerce. And today they're continuing the e-commerce while also back to working with their distributor in Japan, which is their main market where they're exporting.
Outside of learning how to sell outside of Hawaii, I imagine there's plenty of other resources that are coming to the fair. What are some of the other important resources small business owners or those looking to start a business can tap into by coming to the Small Business Fair?
There will be sessions on financing, things like how to read your financial statements. For a lot of companies, they have expressed that to me, that sometimes that might be their weakness. So things like that, how to get ready to get everything in order to be able to go for a loan. Things like HR, there are a couple of sessions on staffing, you know, regulations, things you need to know when you're an employer, if you're going to have employees. And then, of course, we have e-commerce. It's not necessarily e-commerce for international sales. It's just learning about e-commerce and digital marketing. And then we do have a session for companies that may be looking to expand beyond Hawaii, what the resources are and how you can get started.
Can you share the details on how people can attend the Hawaii Small Business Fair?
Yes. So the Hawaii Small Business Fair is on Saturday, September 28th, from 7:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. You can go to invest.hawaii.gov. That's our website where you can register. And you register also for the individual sessions that you want to attend. If it says that it's full, you can still try anyway and come. And even if you don't register, or if you go online a few days before the fair and it says it's closed, you can still come down. Walk-ins are welcome on a first-come, first-served basis. So it's at Leeward Community College.
Jamie Lum, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Lum, Business Development Branch Chief for the state, talking with HVR's Russell Subiono. The Hawaii Small Business Fair, again, will be at Leeward Community College this Saturday, September 28th, from 7:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. And that's it for our show today. I'm Catherine Cruz.